Thank you. You may be seated. Welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case being orally argued, and that's y'all's, of course. I'll introduce the panel that you've got here before we call the case. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand all the counsel have checked in, and so I think we're ready to go if the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call State Farm Lloyds versus Alice Ladkin. May it please the court, Ms. Melissa Norbert will argue for appellant, Mr. Michael Davis will argue for appellee.
Thank you.
Ms. Lorber, it's nice to put a face with a name.
Oh.
We've seen you up here quite a bit. So
good to see you, Your
Honor. Very good to see you.
May it please the court. I want to start by talking about what this case is and what this case isn't. So this is a case where an appraisal panel set the amount of loss, and the Texas Supreme Court has held numerous times that an appraisal award is binding on the parties as to the amount of the loss. This is also a case where Mrs. Ladkin was able to get her roof repaired for the amount of the appraisal award. Her roofer, 911 Roofers, agreed to do the work for $20,179.51, which is the exact amount of the appraisal award issued by her appraiser and the umpire. So this isn't a case where it cost her more to repair the items that were in the appraisal award. She did decide to have some additional decking work done that her appraiser and the umpire did not include in the appraisal award, and she took out a $7,000 loan just to pay for that piece. She hasn't paid 911 Roofers yet for the work included in the appraisal award.
Well, let me ask you this. If I understand State Farm's position correctly, just because there's an appraisal award that says it would cost X to put on a new roof does not bind any insurer to agree that that is a covered loss necessarily, correct?
Right. So the Supreme Court has held as far back and even before the Johnson case, as recently as Barbatech and Ortiz, that it sets the amount of the loss. It decided the damages, but not liability.
So what should an insurer do if it sees the appraisal award but says I'm going to fight coverage in whole or in part, who goes first? What do they have to do?
So I think that they should do exactly what they did in this case. So they agreed to go to appraisal, even though they did not believe that the roof was damaged by hail. They had estimated for a patch of the roof where a satellite dish had come off, and there was wind damage and some interior damage. So they went to appraisal, like the Johnson case says you should do.
Sure.
And then the Johnson case says after appraisal, you can go to court and contest coverage. And so what State Farm did is it looked at the appraisal award and said, okay, we're going to give some more money because the appraiser set the amount of loss for the piece we consider covered, and it was higher than we paid, higher than we estimated, so we'll go ahead and issue a payment, but we still don't believe that hail caused damage to the rest of the roof, so we're going to take that issue to court. And what should have happened, Your Honor, is different than what happened here. The appraisers should have been allowed to come in and their expert and say, we think it was hail. And our expert should have been able to come in and say, we think it wasn't hail. And then the jury should have been able to decide. If it was hail, it was covered. And if it was covered, then the damages were set by the appraisal. If it wasn't hail, it wasn't covered. But the trial court misunderstood the Johnson decision. And so it excluded our expert from coming in and explaining our side of the case. He was allowed to say, I don't think it's hail. But he wasn't allowed to explain what he thought it was, why he thought it was, how hail looks different than wear and tear and mechanical damage.
Did any of his reporting beforehand in terms of the original assessment get in as documentation for the jury's determination?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. So he was not, his company, someone else from his company came out and inspected during the claims handling. And there are very brief line items in the claim file that said, he didn't think it was hail damage. The engineer didn't think it was hail damage. But again, the very brief line items did not get to explain what the expert would have explained at trial, which is, this is why it's not hail. This is why it's, mechanical damage. And this is how those two things look different.
So the report that was done was a line item report that simply said, here's what we think the damage is, but there wasn't an actual narrative report prepared.
Not that went into the jury, I don't believe. There was a report, but what went to the jury, what's in the record, is just a summary. in the claims log. So his actual, the engineer's actual report did not go in front of the jury either. And so we believe a couple of things. First, we ask that the court reduce the amount of the judgment to the amount of the appraisal award. And I'm not saying that there's no case in which hypothetically someone could come in and say the damage got worse after the appraisal award and therefore I get additional damages. But this isn't that case. There was only a brief period of time between when the umpire went out and inspected and issued the appraisal award and when she then got the roof repaired. And there's no evidence in the record at all that in that time the cost went up. And they like to point to what the umpire said at trial is costs have gone up in general, hypothetically 25%. But she'd already repaired her roof a year earlier for the amount of the appraisal award. So there's just not evidence in this case that would allow the award of actual damages to be more than the amount of the appraisal award minus deductible and payment.
Gotcha. So what exactly were State Farm's objections to the umpire's testimony about increased prices in general?
I don't think
relevance,
State Farm objected. It's just not evidence that she was damaged. I mean, it's interesting fact, but it's not damage that she incurred because she had already paid for her roof at a lower price.
My reading of your brief, and I'm looking for it, but I can't find it right off, but is that essentially that if we were to find in favor of State Farm on the damages issues, that would moot your argument with regard to sending it back for new trial? I read there's a line. I know it's argued alternatively, but the way you argue it is essentially that only if you don't agree with us here would we ask for a new trial.
Sure, Your Honor. I think we do argue it alternatively, and I'm not sure exactly what you're pointing to. We would be fine with either. If the court were to reduce the amount of actual damages to the amount of the appraisal award and then find that there's not evidence to support the award of additional damages for a knowing violation, then I think that the judgment, and also look at the statutory 542A.007 has a statutory calculation that limits attorney's fees based on the amount awarded in the appraisal. If those three things happen, then the judgment would probably be close enough to correct that we wouldn't be asking for it to be sent back. However, if the court were to say, find that there is a scintilla of evidence of a knowing violation, then I think that finding is permeated by the fact that our expert wasn't allowed to tell our side of the case. Their whole argument is it was obvious there was hail. They should have known it was hail, and our expert could have come in and taken some heat off of that. Maybe the jury wouldn't have awarded knowing damages. Maybe they wouldn't have found bad faith or unconscionability to begin with. So if we're looking like this judgment is not going to go based on the appraisal award, then we would ask.
Let me ask you, if the evidence, I know you're not going to agree that it does, but if the evidence show there was conspicuous hail damage to the roof and that State Farm turned a blind eye to that, would that be sufficient evidence to support a knowing violation?
I would argue no, Your Honor, and you're right. You prefaced it with we don't agree that that's what the evidence shows. I would say that when you have a knowing violation, to get additional damages, you have to show both a violation of the DTPA and a knowing violation. So it needs to be something more than we got it wrong on the claim. We didn't pay for hail that was covered, or we didn't handle the claim right, so we didn't realize that the hail was covered. It needs to be something more than that to be knowing. And for example, they cite a case called Great American.
Let me ask you again. The premise of my question is that the insurer simply ignored conspicuous damage. Would that be sufficient to support a knowing violation?
Yes, if there is evidence of that, yes. And that was one of the, what I was going to go with this, is there's a case called Great American that they cite where this court in the past has upheld a knowing violation. And in that case, there was evidence of a lot of things that just aren't at issue here. There was an adjuster who wasn't qualified to handle that type of claim, who hired an expert who wasn't qualified to handle that type of claim. The expert, the adjuster didn't do anything other than look to the expert. The expert was results-oriented, wanted to please the insurance company. There's not evidence of any of that here. They don't claim the adjuster is inexperienced. They don't claim the engineer is not experienced or is biased. So this is just a case where their side, their experts, our side, our experts, disagree on what caused the damage to the roof. And so that maybe is a breach of contract. Maybe it gets as far as unconscionable, but I don't believe it gets as far as a knowing violation.
Why could the jury not reasonably infer that taking a photograph that was not sufficiently clarifying to demonstrate whether there was or was not damage to the roof would be evidence of an intentional or knowing intent not to properly evaluate the roof.
The
jury clearly found unconscionability here. The jury clearly found that your expert, and this may get us to the new trial issues, but as it was presented to them, they believed the umpire and the other appraiser, as opposed to your appraiser, with regard to the amount, and that was a significant difference, okay? And so, knowing that we have a jury finding that they didn't believe you did a reasonable job of evaluating the claim to begin with, and that was highlighted by certain aspects of the reporting that was done, why is that not sufficient with regard to either the knowing or the unconscionability finding?
Sure, Your Honor, I'm going to answer that in two parts. The first part of that is I don't believe that that's what the evidence actually shows if you look at it. I mean, there was a bunch of pictures taken, some of which showed hail damage, some of which they say showed hail damage, and some of which didn't. And so is alone the fact that one or two of our photos did not show hail damage when other of them did enough to show a knowing violation? I would argue not. But a bigger picture would circle back and say, yeah, this would then get us to our expert should have been allowed to tell our side of the story. I would believe them too if they were the only ones allowed to tell their side. And we, our experts on the stand, we were allowed to ask the one question, and then the judge cut him off. And they raised this issue at lunchtime on the last day of trial, right before our expert testified. And so feet cut out of underneath of the case, but their expert had already testified without objection. The umpire had testified because we thought our expert was going to be testifying too. And it's all based on a misunderstanding of the Johnson decision. So yeah, if we're looking at, you know, this is obviously hail damage, then we should have been able to testify that it's not, and here's why it's not.
Let me ask you something with regard to two things. One is, I don't recall, and I may be in error here because there was significant briefing done here, mm-hmm. I don't recall an instance where this type of capping occurred. They're arguing that in order to get the benefit of the estoppel from Ortiz and from Barbara Technologies, that you actually have to pay the amount of the appraisal, which you did not do, okay? Even if you subtract the way you're saying you subtract, you didn't do that. It was a check that was sent that was significantly less than the actual appraisal amount. So is there any case law that indicates that appraisal amount under those circumstances does in fact stick in perpetuity and put a cap on the recoverability with regard to any litigation that occurs after that?
Sure, Your Honor. So I would argue, again, I'd like to answer in two parts. One is, I point back to the Ortiz decision in the Supreme Court, and you are correct that factually in that case, State Farm paid the appraisal award more quickly. The Supreme Court did not limit the decision in that case. It said when the only damages you are seeking is what's owed under the policy, you're capped by the appraisal award. Under Menchaca, the Supreme Court's decision in Menchaca and some other cases, they say here are the different types of damages you can get. And what we're saying in this case is maybe it wouldn't be capped if they had some other damage that was caused by the fact that we didn't pay it later. But that's not what the record in this case shows. It shows.
Well, but even in Ortiz, though, even though clearly the appraisal was done after the initiation of litigation, okay, mm-hmm. and therefore the appraisal contractually capped damages in the middle of litigation, the thing that granted the summary judgment was that there was a tender of the full amount of the appraisal award. It wasn't we still think it's not covered, so we're still going to fight it out, but if we do get hit with a jury verdict, we're going to say that appraisal amount. Has any court dealt with, since estoppel is kind of an equity thing, if you can you basically waive it, as they're arguing that it, once you decide not to tender the amount, that's basically gone as a cap?
I've seen that argument. I haven't seen a court adopt it yet.
Well, yeah, I'm just curious. Let's say that there was a case that had the sequencing that I think Justice Birdwell is talking about, which are the facts that we have here. I mean, if an insurance company paid the full appraisal amount and then sued saying we shouldn't have had to pay that much because there's causation coverage issues, and they win, do they go and get a check back from the insured? I mean, how would that work in practice?
Yeah, we say that a lot. I mean, it's unlikely that State Farm would ever sue its insured, right? So once we've paid, or that we'd be able to get it back, right? And so once we've paid. And a lot of times State Farm does pay when it's a questionable call. They just didn't believe it was a questionable call here. And one thing that goes to the equities that you're talking about is there's a whole statute that provides a punishment, a statutory interest under 542, because we waited so long to pay. And that's not insubstantial in this case. On a $14,000 appraisal award, it would be $7,000 in interest. And that's the time value of money, and that's the damages you get when you don't actually sustain any additional damages other than the time value of money.
One final question. I know you're out of time, but they've cited Latot for the standpoint that the mere tendering of the 2000 and change check is not a payment. Okay, and the three cases you've cited, including Hurst and Garcia, all three of those cases dealt with a check that was for the amount of the appraisal. Okay, mm-hmm. Latot, it didn't. And the court found that that wasn't a payment if it didn't cover the full amount of the appraisal. So what's your response to that?
Can I continue?
Yes, yes.
So a couple of things.
Briefly.
One is that the cases that I cite are specifically in the context of an appraisal award, and it's saying if you tender, it's enough. You've complied with your obligations after the appraisal. What ours was a tender of a partial payment of the appraisal award. I don't think that there's case, I know there's not case law that treats that differently than a payment of an appraisal award in whole or part is enough. And their cases actually deal with something slightly different than I understood you to be saying. Theirs have to do with what if we issue a check and we later dishonor it. So if we later dishonored the check, it would be no good and the original obligation would stand. But the cases they cite, and there's a Texas statute, Business and Commerce Code 3.310, that say it's good, it suspends the payment obligation unless and until it's dishonored. And she still has it. It hasn't been dishonored. So I would say our cases are on point in the appraisal payment context and when it hasn't been dishonored.
Was there any evidence in the record with regard to who has the right to dishonor it? Who has the right to dishonor it? Does State Farm or does the bank that State Farm uses have the right? In other words, a check that says it's only good for 180 days or anything. Does any record with
There's
regard
nothing.
To that?
It wasn't okay. addressed in the record.
All right.
Thank you very much. Would you please add 2 minutes to Mr. Davis's time? Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Davis, and I represent the appellee, Ms. Alice Latkin. During my time before the court, I will explain why this court should suggest a remitter of the actual damages and affirm the judgment as modified for two reasons. First, there was sufficient evidence to award actual and additional damages. And second, this court should affirm the award of attorney's fees. But before I get to my 2 points, I feel like I must address 2 points discussed by State Farm today and in their brief. First, in regards to the emphasis that State Farm placed in their brief on our concession that the evidence didn't support an award of $40,000 in actual damages. And to be clear, we are not here to advance an intellectually dishonest opinion. We're here to help the court reach the right result. And that's why we offered three alternative arguments to after this court suggests a remitter of the damages, to bring that damages down to the highest amount that is supported by the evidence. Without waiving the first two, we certainly believe that the first two are supported by the evidence. But by far, the most reasonable and legally sound argument that we make is our third alternative argument, where we accept the argument that the appraisal amount is fixed in perpetuity. Justice Birdwell, you asked about cases where this type of situation has happened, where State Farm denied the appraisal award, and then proceeded through trial, and there was evidence of additional damages. Admittedly, we have not found a case, at least not from the Texas Supreme Court, that squarely addressed that issue.
Well, now, what about the fact that the appraisal amount that you're arguing for didn't take into account the deductible, you know, or the State Farm check, either one? Would her deductible at least come off of that, do you think?
Yes, Your Honor. The deductible would certainly be counted in, but what wouldn't further reduce that fixed appraisal award is the uncertified check that was never cashed, which brings me to the other argument raised by State Farm regarding the evidence of this uncertified check that was never cashed. That argument fails both procedurally and substantively. It fails procedurally because, as this court held in Washington versus Yellowfin, which I believe was authored by Justice Basil and was joined by Justice Birdwell, offset of payment is an affirmative defense pursuant to Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 94 and 95. State Farm had the burden to plead and prove and put that to the jury on their affirmative defense. They did not submit any sort of offset question on their affirmative defense to the jury.
And as a practical matter, would this affect anything more than the prompt pay interest?
It would
and attorney's fees, yeah.
Would the uncertified check affect the prompt pay interest? Yes, it would have some impact on the prompt pay interest because the Texas Supreme Court has held in Anojos and Mextex that when you submit an offer to pay or the uncertified check, which is a conditional offer to pay, that suspends the prompt pay interest from occurring on that check amount. But it does not discharge the original payment obligation. But that's what State Farm wants this court to hold, that they are entitled as a matter of law to an offset of damages for a uncertified check that was never cashed. The Texas Supreme Court has been clear all the way since 1940 in Texas Mutual versus Tolbert that a uncertified check that's never cashed does not constitute payment. And Justice Birdwell, you brought up the Latott case from the Dallas Court of Appeals in footnote 5. The Dallas Court of Appeals addresses the exact same argument that State Farm is making today in Latott versus USAA. USAA made the same argument, and the court held in footnote 5 of that opinion that the Texas Supreme Court has never held that the mere delivery of an uncertified check that was never cashed constitutes payment. Additionally, in Washington versus Yellowfin, this court discussed the requirement for proof of accounting. State Farm cannot show you accounting where that money has ever been transferred out of their account and placed into Ms. Alice Ladkins. In fact, their own claim file says that that check is outstanding and that it has other line items that show what's been paid, but that check has not been paid. So their argument fails procedurally. It also fails substantively because all of the cases that they rely on, Hurst and Garcia and Zhu, none of those cases ever held that an uncertified check entitles someone to offset damages. In fact, those cases didn't even address an offset of damages.
And none of them dealt with partial payments, alleged partial payments. Let me ask you this, counsel. Was there a surety, was there a bond filed in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
The amount of the judgment?
I believe so.
Okay, and maybe this will come to you when you get back up here. Would that have included the amount for the check that was tendered but has not been negotiated by your client?
I'm not sure. I know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Okay.
But if this court will allow us to submit some supplemental briefing.
It's a question because if the judgment already recognizes that and the surety has been filed with the court and we modify the judgment, it gets paid one way or the other. What I'm concerned with is what if we do sort of what's being suggested, I don't want this to come up with, oh, gee, it then gets dishonored after the fact if we take that into account type of thing. And we might not have to do that given the fact we were dealing with a surety as well. So just a thought.
Yes, Your Honor, and I completely agree. It can be dishonored, and we disagree with State Farm that it's dishonored by State Farm. A check is honored by the bank. It can be dishonored by the bank. Furthermore, State Farm can stop payment on this check at any time, and it is undisputed in the record that.
I guess the other thing is that if, in fact, we agree with their argument under those circumstances, given there's a surety, that assures that it gets paid, whether that check eventually gets negotiated or not. So, but anyway, that was just something I thought of. So,
yes,
what evidence do you have of actual additional damage, given the fact that the roof was actually replaced and there was a new roof on as of December 2020?
The evidence that we have of the actual and additional damages that State Farm committed a knowingly unconscionable action is the fact that this house was in a zone that was determined by State Farm to be adversely affected by wind and hail, that we had a contractor who was out there who walked the State Farm adjuster through the chalk marks where he notated the hail damage. And then also, Justice Birdwell, I believe you mentioned taking photos from a faraway distance. We even asked their adjuster about that question.
But those things did not cause Ms. Lagkin to incur any extra expense, correct? That just goes to your claims on the
All the damages that you're talking about, whether they were properly evaluated or not, were fixed by the new roof that went on in December 2020. So my question is since she got the roof for the amount of the appraisal, what additional damages did she actually have that she was getting compensated for?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I understand your question. The reason why I was confused is that we've been referring to additional damages to refer to the knowingly unconscionable action additional damages. But when you're saying additional damages post-appraisal or post-repair, our first two arguments seek damages for those, but our third alternative argument that we're focusing on today is fixed on that appraisal amount.
Okay. There's a 29,000 number in there somewhere. I think that's your second alternative, which is based upon the umpire's testimony that had the appraisal been done at the time of trial, there would have been additional amounts added to the original appraisal because prices had gone up, things of that nature. Are you actually claiming that that's damage that is actually recoverable based upon his testimony?
Yes.
Given the fact that this roof was actually fixed for the original appraisal amount?
Yes, Your Honor. We do believe that the evidence supports that. It's not what we're focusing on here today. We're just focusing on the fixed amount. But yes, we do, in our brief, argue that the evidence supports the award of what was actually, or not just the appraisal award, but what was actually cost Ms. Lagkin in fixing it, what she paid the contractor, and additionally, what was adjusted based on that appraisal award at the time of trial. In turning to when the repairs were done, Justice Birdwell, the evidence is actually a little conflicting on when that evidence when that repair was actually completed. There's some evidence that says it was done in 2020. There's an invoice that says it was completed in 22. We don't deny that there's conflicting evidence here. What we would say is that the jury is entitled to resolve whatever conflicting testimony is put before the jury. The jury is entitled to weigh the credibility of witnesses and believe some more so than others. And so there is conflicting testimony there. But the focus of our argument today really is accepting their argument that that the appraisal award is fixed in perpetuity. And there are some case law that says, Ortiz and Barbatech and so forth, that the facts are different, but they do say that the appraisal award is fixed. And in our third alternative argument, we accept that. We just don't accept the uncertified check that was never cashed. And the significance
is it. I'm jumping around, so I apologize.
No, Your Honor, please do.
Because I'm thinking about it. So did both sides present testimony to the jury that there was some hail damage done at the time? In other words, the original evaluation by State Farm identified hail damage, I believe, to the vents, the metal vents, and also to the metal flashing on the roof, but not to the actual tiles. And your expert and her original estimate was that not only was there hail damage due to damage to the flashing and to the vents, but also to the tiles. Did both sides agree that there was in fact hail damage that the house had actually been hit by hail with regard to that?
Not at the time of the original denial of the claim. When the State Farm's adjuster first came out to review the evidence, he found that there was zero hail damage to anywhere on the roof.
So was the flashing and vent damage that he identified solely wind? Because he identified flashing and vent damage. Was it solely wind? I thought it'd also include hail damage.
My understanding from the record is that the flashing and vent damage wasn't determined, and or State Farm didn't come up with that evidence or that argument until the denial of the neutral umpire appraisal award, that second step in the process where they reached an impasse with the two appraisals.
Maybe I was misreading the record in that regard, that was a part of their appraiser's evaluation during the appraisal process. But at some point in time, one of their experts, that either their appraisal, their original evaluator, the original adjuster, went out and found that the roof did in fact get hit by hail within the time frame.
The original adjuster did not find that the roof had been hit by hail. The later appraiser that they used in the appraisal process determined that there was some damage of hail, but not enough to change the whole roof. That's contrary to what the umpire and what our appraiser said. Additionally,
let me ask you one question. Why did the trial judge keep State Farm's expert from testifying about what the cause of the damage was?
Yes, Your Honor, and the strongest part of our argument there is that was harmless error, if anything, and we show in the brief that the substance of that expert's opinion got in several different ways, including from that very same expert. And I want to be clear, the trial judge here, he wasn't just targeting State Farm's expert. If you look back at the record, he across the board to all witnesses, he was saying, you can't testify outside the scope of this report. In fact, we had multiple objections sustained on us where our own experts were trying to testify to stuff that went outside the report. They objected.
But isn't your theory of a knowing violation that there was obvious damage to the roof from hail?
Yes, Your Honor.
So wasn't the testimony by the expert directly relevant, by State Farm's expert directly relevant to that issue?
Yes, Your Honor, and that information got in. We showed the testimony in our brief where they were allowed to ask their expert, do you think wind and hail caused this damage? And he said no.
But as I understand it, State Farm's problem with that is that all he was able to say was no, and he didn't get to say, and here's what, in my opinion, did cause the damage.
That is State Farm's position, but his expert report that was also, or his the claim file with his findings also made it in to the record and went back with the jury. And if there's anything outside of that report that he was going to testify to, we weren't allowed to testify to that either. Multiple times we were sustained on objections where we weren't allowed to testify what went outside.
So, but did his report actually say, I believe that this damage was caused by normal wear and tear and buckling or whatever the word is?
Yes, Your Honor.
Say that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe his report did show that it was wear and tear. He didn't have the litany of reasons that State Farm later tried to use in explaining why they were denying coverage for this issue. In fact, we questioned all of the witnesses. Did you see marring and tearing and all of these other excuses that State Farm used when they denied our claim? And all of the experts said no. But there are some, he does say wear and tear, but not the entire litany of excuses that State Farm has used and repeatedly changed their reasoning. Furthermore, into the knowingly violation of an unconscionable action, there was a discussion earlier, I think, Justice Kerr, you brought it up, about coverage versus causation. State Farm admits that hail damage is covered by their policy. They deny coverage based on their argument that causation is not something that can be decided by the appraiser or the umpire.
And that's what the contract says. The insurance policy says that, doesn't it?
It does say that State Farm is not bound. That's what the contract says.
Well, of course, the Johnson case, I think, is, you know, not as clear-cut as anybody wants to suggest that it is, but...
Yes, Your Honor. The Johnson case does explain that a necessary part of the job of saying how much this should cost to get repaired requires the appraiser to say this was caused by wind and hail and this was caused by wear and tear. And the neutral umpire here undisputably said it was caused by wind and hail. Our appraiser said the same thing. The initial contractor said the same thing and marked it with chalk. Their adjuster, when he came out, he took pictures from far away and even admitted that it would be difficult to see wind and hail damage from that distance, that he actually took the pictures.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. Did anything, even remotely looking like a narrative explanation of why State Farm's adjuster or appraiser thought that this was not hail damage and it was something else, get into the jury? I know that you've said the claim file got in, but again, was there any opportunity through any documentation or through any testimony for either the original adjuster or the appraiser to explain why they excluded hail as the cause of any damage to her roof? I understand the question about he may have been keep limiting everybody to whatever they reported.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if there wasn't a report with a narrative explanation and all it is checking something off, that's a lot different than a narrative report.
Your Honor, I'm not positive how much detail he really went into in the claim file. I know that he did explain that he thought it was due to wear and tear, that there were some parts of the shingles that were damaged that didn't look like they were hail. But I'm not sure how much detail he went into in his report.
And you just indicated that you went through with each of your experts asking, this is what State Farm claims, is this true? And they said no. Did you then follow up with questions like, why is it not true, and give them the opportunity to explain, or did you just go check mark, check mark, check mark, in which case a rebuttal check mark would seem to be sufficient? That's my question with regard to the record.
It was a check mark, and the best evidence I have, I believe it's the first volume of the reporter's record on page 89. You'll see that when our trial counsel went to ask our appraiser, or the umpire actually, why did you not determine this was wind and hail, or why did you not determine this was wear and tear, the judge stopped it from occurring. The trial counsel for State Farm objected, said this was outside the scope of this document and of this report, and limited his testimony, our own expert's testimony, to that report.
So your argument is basically what's good for the goose was good for the gander.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. And additionally, the expert's causation opinions, or if you want to call it that, they were addressed directly with the check mark that we're speaking to, and all of the people who were who testified, the appraisers, the adjusters, the engineer, all said that there was a number of reasons that State Farm used as an excuse for why it was not accepting this policy or accepting this claim, and all of them gave several reasons that weren't even including in any of their initial reports. State Farm never once followed up with the umpire to ask him why he determined that a whole new roof was repaired. And in the court below, we showed the jury pictures of the hail damage. And I think when this court goes and looks at those pictures, it will also be obvious to this court that there were significant and apparent hail damage that was put before the jury, and the jury is entitled to determine credibility of witnesses, and has entitled to great deference as held by this court in Great American versus Compass in its bad faith findings, and the knowingly unconscionable action finding, and while this court and myself, we might weigh that evidence differently. It is not our job as the lawyers and the justices and judges to make that determination in a jury trial. It is certainly within the jury's scope to make those decisions. And it is for these reasons we ask this court to suggest a remittiture of the actual damages and modify the judgment, affirm the judgment as modified.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lorber.
Your Honors, I think that the thing that struck me most in the questioning of opposing counsel is when Justice Birdwell said what's good for the goose is good for the gander. That's what we want. We wanted our expert to be able to testify like their expert did. Their expert, two of their witnesses got to say, we know what wear and tear is. We don't think this is wear and tear because. We know what blistering, we don't think it's blistering because. Our guy wasn't allowed to just say it, you know, so they were allowed to go through, no, it's not, no, it's not, no, it's not, here's why. We weren't even allowed to go through wear and tear, blistering, any of that at all.
Did y'all make an offer of proof with respect to what your expert would have testified to?
Yes, so his, then this is something else that I wanted to clarify as well. So his expert report is in the record. It did not go to the jury. The jury did not see his report, but it has all of his opinions and what he would have testified to if allowed to testify. And we also discussed that at the hearing. There was a hearing over lunch right before the expert was called where the reason the court struck him was a misreading of the Johnson case, flat out. They argued for pages and pages that Johnson prohibited it. During that, trial counsel reiterated what his opinions would have been, but his whole report is in the court's record, not in the jury record. And one of the other things that our expert would have testified to is that there was a storm in between the time that State Farm adjusted the claim and the umpire went out. There was another hail damage, another storm, when she was insured by a different insurance company in April of 2020, and then May.
Before or after the roof got replaced?
Before the roof got replaced, before the appraisal was finished. The appraisal dragged on and on because their appraiser was having knee surgery, so the appraisal was a long process, but it was before the umpire, the decision maker, went out and inspected the roof and made the decision and issued the award. So it's included in the award. And that's part of what we would, you know, could touch on a little bit at trial, but our expert, we didn't get to put our expert up there and tell our side of the story, and that's another piece that he would have said if allowed to testify.
Were you not given the opportunity to cross-examine the umpire when he testified about the second hailstorm?
Sure. I mean, it's like, I don't recall if we asked the umpire. Yes, we did. Because we asked the umpire, when the original inspections were done, there was one tarp on the roof, and it was covering just where the wind blown was. And when you went out there, there was another tarp on the roof. But there's a difference between adversely questioning an opposing side's witness. I mean, this guy was invested in the fact he thought it was hail, right? And being able to put on our own expert to tell our side of the story. I mean, those are two different things. So we were able to touch on it with that witness, but not in the way that we would have.
Well, I guess you expected that your expert was going to get to testify.
It wasn't a question until lunch, right before the last day of trial, right before he was called. So, yeah, so we would touch on things with other witnesses, but we were not anticipating that he wouldn't be permitted to testify. Their whole theory to the jury and to this court of why this was a knowing violation is because the hail was real bad and because we knew that the Supreme Court held against our position in Johnson. And neither of those, in the first one, if the hail was real bad, we should have gotten to say why it wasn't hail. The second one is, we're not wrong on what, you're completely right when you said Johnson's not as clear as everyone says, but their argument is, Supreme Court had clearly ruled against us, and so it was a knowing violation not to pay the appraisal. That's not what Johnson held. Johnson held a little bit of a few things, but one quote that I always like to come back to is, appraisers cannot rewrite the policy. No matter what the appraisers say, State Farm does not have to pay for repairs due to wear and tear or any other excluded peril because those perils aren't excluded. But we were told, the jury was told, that we didn't follow the Supreme Court's opinion, and they're asking the court to now say we did it knowingly based on a misinterpretation of the Supreme Court's opinion. So we ask the court to either reduce the judgment to the amount of the appraisal award minus both the deductible and the payment. the facts about the payment are undisputed, both when it was paid, how much was paid, and that she still has the check and it hasn't been dishonored. So whether that's an offset defense that's been proven as a matter of law, or whether it's a partial estoppel for the amount that's paid, it's the fact that it's a legal question. The facts underlying it are not in dispute. And if the court is not, and then the attorney's fees are also impacted by this payment, because if the payment is deducted, we get under the 0.8%. If the payment is not deducted, which I think is the real reason we're fighting over the $2,400, right, is because how it impacts attorney's
B.
fees.
Yeah.
So if the court is not going to reduce the judgment to, you know, the three steps that we say, then we'd ask for a new trial where we're allowed to put on our side of the case. I appreciate your time.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your case is submitted, and we appreciate your being here for oral argument. It's been very helpful to us, and with that, we'll stand in recess.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit is now standing adjourned.